Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy.
Hi everyone, this is Jan.
And this is Helen.
We decided following the incredible CCD Second Symposium to invite one of our colleagues on for a chat. The symposium was initially planned for late 2020, but due to unnamed events in our world, had to be revamped to be online, therefore occurred later than expected in March 2021. But it was well worth the wait. We didn't participate in the first one, Helen and I, but we will certainly be keeping our eyes and ears open for the third.
With the nature of this particular discussion, we refer to lots of other clinicians, research papers, and a couple of assessments. We've done our best to list links to all of these in the show notes, so if you want to give people a follow on Twitter or read more on a topic, hopefully the notes for this episode will be a good starting point.
And Helen, I'm sure we're both sick to death of apologising for recording issues, and I'm sure our listeners are also sick to death of hearing us apologise. So, without further chat, let's get into the chat.
Hello everyone, hope you're all well. This is Helen.
And this is Jan.
This is the first time Jan and I have recorded an episode from the same spot, so that's exciting for us.
It is.
And we also have a guest with us this week, Vicky Mayer, who has come on to talk to us.
Vicky, unfortunately, is not with us, and so Vicky is in Edinburgh, and we're through here in Hamilton. Yep. So, hi, Vicky. Thanks for joining us. Will you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. How nice of you to invite me here. So, I'm speech and language therapy clinical lead for acquired brain injury rehab at NHS Lothian. And I coordinate the neuro rehabilitation speech and language therapy team at the Astley Ainslie Hospital, where we have our neuro rehab unit, and also the Robert Ferguson unit at the Royal Edinburgh Hospital, which is our sister unit for patients with neurobehavioural problems.
Thanks, Vicky. So we invited Vicky on to talk with us about a conference that we all attended in April, the second Cognitive Communication Disorders Symposium. It took place online, which allowed lots of people to participate, and was organised by Dr. Nick Benn, Claire Farrington Douglas, and Simon Grobler. And well done to them for pulling it all together online, so the learning was available globally. I'm sure that wasn't an easy task.
I think we've mentioned before on the podcast that Jan and I are part of an informal professional development group where we try and meet up and share thoughts and ideas. And certainly the symposium created a lot of discussion amongst our little group, and we thought it would be useful to share some of that with our listeners. Particularly if you weren't able to attend, we hope you can still get a flavour of what was covered and inspire you to hopefully attend the third one, which should happen in a couple of years' time, here's hoping. If you do follow us on Twitter already, you'll have seen various live tweets sent out across the 2 days of the conference. So we'll just dive straight in, and I would love to ask you, Vicky, what were the highlights of the symposium for you?
Ah, yeah, it was a great experience, wasn't it? Although slightly odd to be at a symposium sitting at my kitchen table. I suppose taking it from the top, I really enjoyed hearing Carmen Verhoek, who spoke about tools for screening cognitive communication disorder. And I was really interested that having looked at various tools, she picked out the CABI, the CCC-ABI, as perhaps the most useful and feasible tool. And that's great because that, of course, is free and available on the internet. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see if there's further work done on the effectiveness of the CABI.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting hearing her speak. And we obviously appreciate that cognitive communication disorders are largely underdiagnosed, and so perhaps having access quite easily to a screening tool that could be used really by anyone, couldn't it? I don't think Carmen was even saying it needs to be speech therapists. But if it means that there can perhaps be earlier identification of potential issues, of making sure that people are getting referred to speech and language therapy at the right time, and also if it means that that individual and their family get more information and support at an earlier stage, I think we can all appreciate the benefits that that would have.
I couldn't agree more. I find the CABI really, really helpful. Apart from in a clinical perspective, I also find it really helpful to try and explain the role of speech and language therapy. We do use it as well to structure our speech and language therapist formulations and reports, which then feeds into the broader psychological formulation. I really like the last section on the cognitive skills, you know, what's it called, thinking, reasoning, all those sort of higher level language functions. And it supports us discuss things when we're contributing to the discussion with the rest of the team. The CABI, I think, came from that earlier article that Sheila McDonald wrote on a model for cognitive communication disorders. When that was first published, we read it as a multidisciplinary team, and I was really, really pleased at how the team responded to that. I think it helped us with that age-old question of, you know, what is it that speech and language therapists do? And then there's always the Favres, or Favors, depending on how you say it, by Sheila McDonald, which, again, I've used a few times for people who are perhaps wanting to return to work. So I think Sheila McDonald has made a great contribution to our field as well.
Yeah, definitely. And just to say, we will put a link to the CABI within the show notes as well. So if you're not familiar with it, as Vicky said, it is out there online to be looked at, and you'll be able to access a link to that from the show notes.
Yeah. So thanks. Yeah, Vicky, the CABI was really, really interesting. So anything else that you're thinking about?
Yes, I was very interested in Melissa Brunner's presentation on social media use after brain injury. And then that tied in later in the symposium with Kelly Doherty and Susie Patterson's case study about a patient's capacity to function online after their brain injury. I mean, I'm a total Luddite in relation to social media. WhatsApp is about as far as it goes. I do follow you on Twitter now. But it's a hugely significant form of communication for many of my patients now. And I think as brain injury professionals of all disciplines, we should be giving this much more consideration, both in terms of facilitation and then, of course, consideration of the risk that comes along with social media use after brain injury. And I think the development of the online training tool, Social Ability, is really promising. And I do take on board Melissa's point. She said, you can learn about most things from looking them up on YouTube. So maybe that's what I need to be doing.
Yes, if in doubt, search on YouTube. There's bound to be a guide there. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting shift in recent years. I think, unfortunately, we'll be aware that the demographics of those, particularly with traumatic brain injuries, are young men. And so we've got a group of people who have grown up surrounded by technology and social media. So you saying that, you know, maybe not feeling that confident about working with social media raises a good point. And who would have thought that as speech and language therapists, this would be an area for professional development to become skilled in that. But here we are. But definitely, I think considering how someone is interacting with others online is something that's cropping up more and more. I've certainly had individuals I've worked with who have tried online dating, some with great success and some that have had perhaps less success. But I think we've got a role with helping people understand what they're getting themselves into, and also how to interact with new people following brain injury. And I've known families who have been worried around checking that perhaps the person their loved one's talking to online is who they say they are. Aside from dating, you know, thinking about scams, thinking about making sure you're not sharing personal information to anyone and everyone. How do people cope with the numerous trolls that we find online that cover every aspect of social media? It's fair to say social media and online interactions can be a minefield for the best of us. And unfortunately, many people after brain injury do struggle with reasoning skills and making quick judgments about situations. So, Melissa Brunner's work on social media and online interactions is, I suspect, a growing area for us all and will become more and more important. And just with you saying about the social ability training tool, I've seen via Twitter that Dr. Brunner and Dr. Rachel Redick, who I think co-designed these tools, have been presenting more about this. And again, we'll have a link to that information about their lab and the work in the show notes. What do you make of social media, Jan?
I couldn't agree more on feeling totally out of my depth with social media. I mean, I've got all the accounts, but I don't really know how to use them effectively. You know, they're really just a big address book for me. But like you're saying, I mean, have people, not just young people, who previous to their brain injuries were proficient social media. I think it's a really difficult medium to police, and that's not a word I like to use. But I guess after a brain injury, like you're saying, Helen, people can be vulnerable and need additional support, yet often lack insight into the areas that they need help with. So they'll be continuing to use social media, but not always judging the social situations correctly. And this can be exacerbated because of the social media medium. And hey, you know, even without a brain injury, don't we hear it all the time, people getting scammed on the internet? And it's not only the person with the brain injury and how they use social media, but it can be how other people in their social network are using it. So there's a guy that I've worked with for many years who's got a girlfriend who's an avid user of social media and has lots of male friends. And we use that term loosely because, you know, she's never met them. But, so this causes a lot of friction in the relationship. Things like sleep, so he's dealing with fatigue and, you know, all this social anxiety about, you know what his girlfriend's saying online. I mean, the internet is always open, isn't it? And there's always someone awake wanting to have a chat. But in saying all of them, you would keep an amazing opportunity. Anything that can help personal safety has to be really valuable. So roll on, social ability, I'll be signing up. Anything else, Vicky, that it sprung you as particularly interesting?
Yes, there was a repeated theme, I think, wasn't there, on the value of group interventions for cognitive communication disorder. And I suppose I was particularly struck by Jerry Hoopner and colleagues from the States, who have been training people with brain injury in motivational interviewing, which I'm not really familiar with the aim of helping people become better peer supporters. I suppose their view was that sometimes, even with the best intentions, peer supporters can sometimes offer advice that's heavy-handed or at worst even harmful. And so by training people to help others draw out their own solutions and reasons to change, perhaps the group becomes more useful for everyone.
Yeah, we do a few groups in my service. And I think you're right, motivational interviewing is, you know, a really great skill. Helen and I were just reflecting earlier about, you know, what does motivational interviewing actually look like? And I think as speech and language therapists, it is something that we are particularly skilled at least I hope so. And I like to talk, that acronym OARS, really helpful. So O is for ask, A is for so on the person's feelings or concerns, R is for reflecting, so mirroring or rephrasing what the person's saying, and S for summarising together. So I think, you know, when you boil motivational interviewing down into some key skills, I think, you know, that's something that we do really well. And you know, about all the brain injuries, and it reminds me of the project-based focus at the moment, and I do my best to step back as much as I can. I used to run the session where people in the group would try to guess like a current news story from a set of clues, and I'd work with one person who'd volunteered to help me run the group, and we'd pick a news story together and get them, support them to find the clues to help people guess what it was, and then I would try and facilitate them running the session. So that's the closest that I've got to really doing a project-based approach, but unfortunately, you know, I've kind of stepped away from that. So there's a personal goal for me, back more solution focused.
Yeah, I was just asking you as an aside, if you had the chance to run any project-based groups after we had both done the course with Nick, hadn't we?
No, I admit I haven't. And I think there are various reasons for that. I think partly it's to do with the setting in which I work. We see patients pretty early in their rehab journey, so they're post-acute. And I think at that stage, a lot of what we're doing is raising awareness, trying to build insight, educating the person, educating their families and friends and supporters about the potential changes to communication. So I wonder if some of the project-based work sits better further along the journey of recovery in cognitive communication disorder. Also, I suppose, of course, during the pandemic, it's been very difficult to bring groups together, and we're only just now starting to feel our way with the potential to do that in the inpatient setting. But I think it's an incredible way to work. I think it would be so interesting to be involved in a project-based group.
I think how I think about it as well, Vicky, is that sometimes our people are quite diverse, and they are diverse people by nature, and that perhaps we need to think about a project as more of an individual thing, and maybe that's where it aligns quite nicely with motivational interviewing, is that, you know, through motivational interviewing, it's not you, the therapist, telling the person what they need to do, but you are actually leading them, supporting them to come to their own solutions. And so the project is not a group thing. It might be, okay, so you want to catch the bus into town. That's the project, catching the bus into town. So let's work together using motivational interviewing techniques to develop that, you know, and maybe that's how we can think about it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've only had one experience of trying a project-based group since that course with Nick, and it was a small group, and what the guys agreed to try and work on was a leaflet to share with people about what was important to them for people to know about traumatic brain injuries. And it was interesting around kind of what you were saying, Jan, around stepping back, and you might see that things are maybe not absolutely perfect, but you kind of had to be okay with that. And I wonder if there's an element of that with motivational interviewing. It's not about you. Mm-hmm. It's about what that person's taking from it. And I got that feeling from Jerry's presentation. And just to go a slight tangent, what I would say about Jerry's presentation, it was himself and a lot of his students, wasn't it, that presented on that. And I have to say well done to all of them, because I think with the time difference, they were, I think, maybe presenting very early in the morning. And undergraduate students, and they did a tremendous job. I thought, I'm not sure I would have been able to do that at that stage. So well done to them. And I'm aware of time for and you've given up so much of your time already, Vicky, but we can't talk about the symposium without talking about Lynn Terkstra and Leanne Tor's sessions, can we? What did you make of them?
Oh, absolutely. They were both inspirational in those huge, generous presentations that they had both put together. I suppose Lynn's, it was a real drawing out of social cognition, theory of mind, and social communication impairment. And just to hear somebody talk about those concepts side by side was a real education for me, I'll be honest. It was fascinating. I think I was particularly struck by her comment that not all communication skills are trainable. That feels like a relief. It's not just that I haven't thought of a way to train it. Some are just not trainable. So she gave the example that you can't teach the ability to infer. And so you have to teach mitigating strategies instead. And so I felt that was a really important thing to take on board. I also loved her phrase, practice a million times makes perfect. And the fact that we need to be giving our patients so many opportunities to practice these skills over and over and over again in so many different contexts and with different communication partners, because that's the only way that it will generalize and become their new normal. So therapy needs to create a situation where that person can practice their skills outside of the clinic room routinely. Such an important point, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a really interesting thing that I've come to realise over the last few years, but there's still, I think, maybe a feeling that speech therapy does take place within a clinic room or in a one-to-one session. So if we talk about maybe seeing someone in a coffee shop or at the gym or in the workplace, there's the feeling that we don't quite belong there yet. But I liked Lynn's presentation for suggesting that actually it's okay for us to push ourselves into that and elbow our way in. And yeah, Lynn's kind of points around social communication, social functioning is so nuanced, and after brain injury people can find that incredibly difficult. But it's also very costly to make a mistake. I think that was a really important point she made, because people do form impressions quickly, but people can also be quite forgiving. So if you make a good first impression and then you make a mistake a bit further down the line, people will often be more forgiving of that. And I think when we think about it, we probably know that, but do we really impart that to our patients? And I just thought it's an interesting point to reflect back on. And also, I know I think about this a lot, but worth repeating what Lynn had said around our communication is influenced by who we are talking to, and that links back to the cognitive communication model that we mentioned earlier on in the episodes. All these different domains and different factors that influence how we respond and how we interact. And so, hey, no wonder it's difficult to rehab cognitive communication disorder. There's so many parameters from a communication point of view, but add in someone's maybe got some anxiety, there's unpredictability in life, there can be lots of overwhelming information, the environment can be overwhelming. It begs the question, what can we do as therapists, doesn't it? Because I think we're all learning that it is more about strategies, less about the impairment-based therapy. Giving strategies to the individual, but to the family as well. I thought we could do a whole episode talking just about those sessions, couldn't we? I know I've got lots of other thoughts, but I'm not going to hold court. Jan, what did you make of it all?
First of all, yeah, what a privilege. I actually didn't really attend to the agenda when I booked, because I just knew it was going to be awesome anyway. And then when I realised, wow, whole half-day sessions with both those gurus in our field, I just thought, oh, I was gobsmacked. But what I took from Lynn's session and applied immediately was that concept of first impressions, which you just mentioned, Helen. I've been working with a guy who the first impression when you meet him is of someone who comes across as quite anxious. He's got poor eye contact, flat affect, he's a little bit fidgety. Yet when you ask him how he is, he'll say, no, I'm great. So, you know, I've been giving him, doing some video feedback with him, just showing how he comes across, doing some role plays where I'll model his behaviours and ask him how he feels about that. And then we set some, you know, quick and easy first impression goals, you know, so it's like look and smile, then say hi. So that's his mantra. And so he's been practicing that and he's been doing so well with it. And I've even, you know, he's even able to really keep conversations going with me where I'm not giving him very much communication feedback, and he's the one who's got to work really hard, and he does so well. So then we've started taking on board what Lynn was saying about practice. So I run round the service telling all the staff, if when we come and say hi, don't say hi to him, he's got to say hi to you, and he gets to practice. And now we're, unfortunately, because everything's been shut, we haven't really gone out much. But as of this week, we're going to start going out into the community, and so that he can practice with members of the public, you know, going ordering coffee and really focusing on those, making eye contact, smiling and saying hi. So, yeah, first impressions.
Mm-hmm. So important. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Leanne's session, that was great as well. I know you had loads of thoughts on that, didn't you, Jan? You were...
Well, I was very fortunate I think it was 2012, 2013, to have the opportunity to do a two-day course with Sheila McDonald on cognitive communication disorders. And, you know, something that Leanne Tor said about, you know, get self-coaching. I thought, oh, I remember that. I remember, you know, how inspired I was when I'd learned about that with Sheila McDonald. So following the course with Sheila, I had been working with a younger man who was, you know, displaying some sexualized behaviors in the community. So I'd been banging on about, this is, you know, these are the boundaries. And he's like, yeah, I know, but I don't care. So then I sat down with him and we came up with some targets, you know, like how would you like people to see you when you're in the community. And so he described the sort of behaviors that he thinks would have been good for him to practice in the community, in his words. And then he wrote a script and then he did a video of himself on his phone. And I still remember the first few words. It's, hi me, this is me. It's in my mind, I'll never lose it. And so I encouraged him, like a social story format of, you know, talking positively about his behaviours and why he might want to practice them. And then also trying to get him to watch this every day. So every day I was at work, I'd go and say, oh, let's watch a video together, you know. And so he'd watch it. And we did that for quite some time. And we'd still be going out in the community and I'd be giving him feedback and reflecting with them on how he'd managed with the behaviours that he'd self-identified. And so I'm so delighted. I think we did that work about 8 years ago, and I still see him, not for intervention, but I still see him around. And I'm so pleased to say that he's actually maintaining these behaviours. So it's been a real success.
Is that something that you feel is applicable within your setting, because you're obviously quite acute and you're seeing people quite early on? Do you think kind of self-coaching is something that can be utilized at that stage?
I think there's possibilities. As we said before, patients are all so different. There is such a diverse group. So I think for some people, yes, very much that might be possible. I think the whole notion of social stories is really interesting. And that's something I've not learned very much about. So I think another podcast in the future on social stories, Jan, might be in order.
Oh, thank you, Vicky. Because my background is that I have worked with people with autism or children with autism, it is something that I used previously. So when I first came to working with adults with brain injury, it seemed like a fairly a strategy that might transfer quite well. And I actually am pleased to say that I have done a presentation at a conference and then at a study day. So, you know, we could revamp it.
Well, there's an episode already there waiting then, isn't there? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And Leanne talked about kind of assessing discourse as well. So that idea about when we talk, it's about sharing information and being able to have different types of discourse. And what that can tell us about someone's kind of cognitive skills, their attentional skills, their planning, their organising. And it was, I just wondered how are we all looking at that at the moment? With difficulty or is it easy?
For me, I'm still using sort of formal assessments, but the sort of strategies that are suggested in the MCLA, and you know, so you do a picture description, or I like to use the flower pot. Again, Sheila McDonald suggested that way back when, so I like the flower pot. But we've just downloaded the Brisbane. I don't know if anybody's aware of the Brisbane. It's an evidence-based language test, so that's free to download. So we've done that, and they do the cookie theft as their discourse sample. But then I like the MCLA with the procedural narrative. I think that can be really interesting. You get someone who might not say anything, someone who'll tell you, get the eggs out to crack them, you know, every little detail goes into it. And then I usually go, can you give me it in 5 steps and see how they manage with that? And then also the personal narrative, you know. So, but I really like the idea that we've been hearing about, you know, about that joint sort of using a familiar communication partner to do some of those tasks. There's an article on that pragmatic rating scale as well. It's coming more and more the recommended way, isn't it? But familiar partners, really tricky to get, isn't it?
Yes, I agree. I mean, I loved the ideas. Leanne gave such practical ideas, didn't she, in the presentation about having the person and their communication partner left alone in the room being recorded, looking at an object that you might not recognize instantly, and have them discuss what they thought it was and what it would be used for. And I love that so often would bring out humor as well as reasoning and problem solving and sharing opinions and that kind of thing. We struggle, I'll be honest, in our organisation at the moment with using video. There's a lot of obstacles to using video, but it's perfectly clear to me from everything that we've learned that video is the way forward. It is the way to give people feedback on their communication, on their discourse.
Oh, definitely. I think I'd probably face similar obstacles to yourself, Vicky, in terms of using video. And I suppose the upside of where I am being more in a community team is that if I've got someone who is at home and has family around them, I can say to them, how about you video when an interaction occurs that is something that we need to reflect back on. And so sometimes that then ends up being quite helpful, because then that's easy for them to access and they can look back at it several months down the line and maybe kind of go, I can't believe that I was doing that. And yeah, when people said that I needed to change a certain aspect of my communication, okay, they were right. And it's hard, because it's hard to have that self-reflection, isn't it? And lots of people struggle with that anyway. And after a brain injury, it can become very difficult for people to do that. So yeah, it's fair to say there was lots that we took from those 2 days. And yeah, I think we're all really looking forward to the next one, whenever it might be. Hopefully it'll be online, as much as I'm sure we would all love to be able to maybe go to Australia or something. I'm not sure quite budgets will allow for that.
And you know what? I found the online quite easy to participate in. I mean, you know, when you go to a conference, you generally aren't interacting with the speakers anyway. So if it makes it more accessible, I think it's a great way to go for conferences.
Yes, I think you're right. It's opened up many opportunities that that we would otherwise not have had, for sure. I guess you sort of miss out on some of the networking around and about the main sessions, but no, I think it's more than offset by the ability to see speakers from around the world.
Yes, and on that matter, we have the Royal Colleges Conference coming up in October. Give a wee plug for them. So hope to see you there.
Yes, indeed.
Not physically, of course, but
virtually.
Yes.
Yeah.
See you virtually there.
Yeah. So Vicky, as we're kind of coming to the end of our recording, we always ask our guests, what would you say is the most important thing that you would take listeners to take away from thinking about the symposium?
Yes, I guess what I would say is that cognitive communication disorder recovery and rehabilitation is a long and multifaceted journey involving many stages, often with long gaps in between those stages. And that we should be prepared to consider acquired brain injury in the same light as progressive neurological disorder. And I guess be prepared to return again and again to these individuals as their symptoms and their readiness for therapy evolve. And really, I'd like to thank Lynn Grayson for that observation in her presentation at the symposium. It was great to hear Lynn speak at the symposium, and her message was also very powerful.
Thanks, Vicky, for joining us tonight.
It's been an absolute pleasure and a most novel experience.
Novel is the word, I suspect. Slightly stressful for listeners. We had a few technical issues at the start. Don't think that was anything in particular any one of us could have done anything about. That's just the beauty of podcasts.
And we do hope that the recording works, so we don't have to repeat.
It was so lovely to have Vicky come and talk with us. She's such a wonderful person and so experienced. Thanks, Vicky. You are welcome anytime. Vicky mentioned something that I missed when we were chatting, but on listening back to her, it has really inspired me. She mentioned peer support, so people with brain injuries supporting each other within our groups using oars. I know it came from Jerry Hoopner's talk, but it just shows you that sometimes you need to hear things a few times before it takes root. Anyway, what I've done since Vicky was chatting with us is create posters for our group rooms that explains oars in easy language. And I'm using that as my, I guess you would say, group rules, so to speak. So it's not quite direct training as Jerry talked about, as our groups are more of a drop-in by nature. So it needs to be a little bit less formal.
I agree, Jan. I think with the variety and variableness and wide-reaching nature of cognitive communication, we can't adopt a one-size-fits-all approach, which is maybe perhaps why we all felt oars and motivational interviewing was a good fit, precisely because it is about reflecting and noticing and wondering and going on a journey with your patient or your client. I think we could have easily talked for hours about the symposium, couldn't we? But rather than being verbose, we kept it short.
So again, do check out the links in the show notes. As we said in our discussion with Vicky, social media can offer great opportunities, and the Brain Injury Clinical Community on Twitter is great for spotting new research and sharing ideas, asking questions. As always, thank you to you guys, the listeners, for tuning in. We'll be back soon with another episode before we take a little break to plan some future episodes. So bye for now.
Bye.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.